Hi, today is January 20th, 2018, and this is Mobius Podcast number 238. I'm Tato Gasawara with my good friend John Westfall, and I hope everyone is having a nice missile-free weekend. That's my new catchphrase for the weekends.
That might be a catchphrase for a while. I mean, that's something you should not ever take for granted after last weekend.
After last weekend, it's not any missile-free weekend or day, for that matter, is a good one.
I agree with that.
Yep. Okay, a couple of things. I don't think we have any big news, but a couple of things I noticed. One, I literally just like an hour ago noticed that I have a system update for my Pixel 2. It is an update to Android OS 8.1.0, which I already have. Mm-hmm. It is not a minor point upgrade, so it's not like 8.1.1. It's just an update to 8.1.0 itself. It's only 48 megabytes, so it's, you know, by today's standards, tiny. Mm-hmm. And it says, this update fixes critical bugs and improves the performance and stability of your Pixel 2, which quite honestly has been pretty stable. I haven't had the problems that I guess that 2XL people have had. And that's it. And it says, we're starting now to update. So being brave, I'm going to do that. Okay. So it's already downloaded, so it shouldn't affect our web thing.
We hope.
And I see you sent me something, so I'll pause. Oh, okay. We
can talk about that. That will be for later topic.
Okay. John just sent me a photo of something we're going to talk about at the end of the podcast. So there's that. Surprise to me. 8.1.0 mm-hmm. update for my Pixel 2. It's rebooting now. We'll see what it does. Related to it, my Pixel 2 is on Project Fi, which is Google's MVNO, which uses a whole bunch of networks. T-Mobile, Sprint, U.S. Cellular, and... usable overseas and so forth. Anyway, Project Fi just switched from their $10 per gigabyte a month plan. It's still, actually, I shouldn't say kind of switched because it's still $10 per gigabyte. The change is if you hit 6 gigabytes of data use in a given billing period, they stop billing you. So the most you ever pay for data is $60 on top of your normal, $20 for voice and texting. So the most you'll ever pay is $80. What they do, however, is they stop charging, but if you hit 15 gigabytes in a billing period, they slow you down. I think that's pretty reasonable.
I have thought about going with Project Fi just to have a modern Android device to play with.
Mm-hmm.
But I meant to bring this up a couple of weeks ago. It must have been like a missile scare or something that stopped me thinking about it last week. But I can't seem to motivate myself to the idea of carrying two phones.
Well, having carried two phones for many years now, it's not a bad thing. And what am I saying? You used to carry like a bazillion phones.
But I never used them at the same time. I never had like two daily drivers at a time.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that.
One phone that was the daily driver, and then the rest would be sitting in the bag, sort of
swap.
I'd pop a SIM card in and out of it. So I guess that's because I've never had a job that's had a work issued cell phone, so I've never gotten the mindset of carrying two things. Right. But that was the thing that literally stopped me from pulling the trigger a few weeks ago. Was going, I'm going to buy this thing.
We're trying not to use the word trigger here anymore, by the way, but...
Oh, that was the thing that literally stopped me from pushing the button.
Hey, no buttons either.
That was the thing that literally stopped me from... what other wonderful puns and other things can I
use? We're a little touchy about those words.
Yeah.
In any case, yes.
It stopped me from firing off an order, yeah.
Plus, I mean, why do you need to pay more money for, when you have a... cell service on one phone that works fine for you. I only happen to have it because I've just been a dual carrier for so long. For a while I had, let's see, what did I have? For a while I had a Windows phone, actually Windows Mobile, and an Android.
And you couldn't do it. Yeah.
I had Android and, then I had a Windows phone and an iPhone. Then I dropped Windows Phone altogether, of course, back in 2012, and it's been iPhone and Android, and I found both of them so compelling that I just hate to just have one. And when Fi became available, for essentially $30 a month, right, because I can pretty much stay under a gig a month if I, stay in, if I only use my Fi phone, I went in Wi-Fi, which is normally available. It hasn't been too bad, but yeah, mm-hmm. if I weren't me, I'd save the $30 a month or so.
And I'm already on Verizon, which is the most expensive carrier under the planet anyway. So I'm paying like three phones equivalent anyway. But
wow.
I'm also in the middle of nowhere where I just really need cell signal. So
right.
That lets me. In fact, I'm thinking this week I have to make a drive up to Memphis, which is about 2 hours away, and I will be driving through parts of the state that do not have very good cell coverage, but I will have coverage the whole way. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to see if my phone is back. Yes, it has rebooted. And I appear to have – I'm connected to the cell system again, so the update didn't brick me, so I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks may remember in old days that upgrading a phone meant the possibility of bricking was in double-digit percentages.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still a little superstitious in that regard.
Very true.
Okay. Next item I have up is – probably a short item – is Windows only. Steve Gibson of GRC, Gibson Research, has a tiny, by today's standards, free tool called Inspector. Inspectre, which is a meltdown spectre checker for Windows devices. So if you have a Windows device, it's, you know, typical Steve Gibson. It is small, fast, and simple. Basically, you download this relatively small .exe file. You run it. It has a little GUI window that pops up and tells you what your meltdown and spectre vulnerability level is. Well, not level, but whether you are to one or both. So if you are concerned about the security of your system, you may want to go to grc.com and check it out. Read about it, you know. Don't go in my word. Read what Mr. Gibson has to say about it. And you are now a Windows user again, John. You might want to check it out in here.
Yeah, the only device I have is the Surface Pro 4, so I'm not sure if that is vulnerable or not. I've not checked.
Yeah. Speaking of vulnerable, so after our thankfully missile-free weekend last week, I've become quite an aficionado of a website called NukeMap, and I'll put the URL in our show notes later. But NukeMap was developed by an academic who specializes in nuclear weapons and that sort of thing. And it does an estimate of blast zones for a nuclear bomb. And you can adjust things like whether it's a ground-level explosion, air, how high it is, number of kilotons. And then it'll give you sort of the, you know, vaporization radius, the, you know, the and then another radius, a larger radius for, you know, the just the blast without the, not without heat, but, you know, the non-vaporized area and fallout and all kinds of stuff, number of casualties. It's, given its topic, I'm going to use the word fun in quotes, but it's quite fun to use, to see what's would happen in your vicinity, especially. And after last weekend, I thought I understood what the blast radii were for various things, but apparently, according to this tool, I did not, because I hadn't really thought about the number of kilotons that could be dropped on us. So, anyway, fun thing. Made for an interesting lunch hour discussion with a couple of coworkers when I threw it up on the screen.
Well, I am, I'm on the website right now.
Yeah.
And, I'm trying to think where I live is almost middle of nowhere, so I'm curious if anyone, like, what would be the nearest thing anyone would ever want to drop on me. And I'm thinking Memphis, and I should be safe where I'm at.
Yeah, well, and, you know, speaking of middle of nowhere, Hawaii is literally the most remote, largely populated area in the world. I mean, yes, there are other populated islands, but, you know, we have over a million people total, I guess, so. Anyway, we have that distinction.
Yeah, even the biggest bomb on that website, I'd still be a good 80 miles away from it if they went to downtown Memphis. So
right.
Yeah, interesting. Kind of morbid, but interesting to play with.
Right, and, you know, we like morbid.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of morbid, something you threw up on the show notes that we can discuss.
Well, I found out a very interesting thing this week. From time to time, I teach human factors engineering, and so I am well aware of a number of mistakes over the last 50 years and why they were caused with just different case studies. And so this week I was talking with some people right after discussion of the user interface for the alert system that was accidentally triggered over last weekend. And I noticed a very interesting trend. When you talk to people about very important things, such as missile notification systems, they tend to have this linear sort of thinking, and our brains are wired for linear thinking. We like to think that a small push results in a small movement, a big push results in a big movement.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like non-linear small push, big outcome.
Right.
But I think this extends. I think it's the same phenomena that says if something's very important, it must be well designed. because talking to people, I actually have people say, no, I think this was a conspiracy. Of course, a lot of people have conspiracy beliefs about mm-hmm. everything.
We love conspiracies.
I think this is a conspiracy. I think something really did happen because I just can't believe that one person mm-hmm. could make one little mistake and cause mm-hmm. this much trouble. Which, history of human factors engineering is littered with one person making one little mistake and causing a lot of trouble.
Right.
The Great New York Blackout of 1977 was literally a power operator sitting at a panel thinking he was doing one thing because he was pressing a button that was in the middle of a selector switch. So imagine a little button surrounded by a dial, and the dial you turn to different options, and you hit the button in the middle to actuate. And he believed that he was tripping certain blocks for power to try to save the whole grid, and in reality he had the dial set wrong and he was doing something that was completely ineffective.
I did not know that.
So literally a notch, a difference of a dial notch, is why the Great New York Blackout of 1977 happened. And then you get into sociologists and anthropologists who believe the Great Blackout of 1977 caused the rise in hip-hop music.
What?
Because due to some unfortunate criminal activity that happened during that blackout, equipment that did cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars got on the black markets for tens of dollars, you know, sound equipment and DJ equipment and production equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are people who believe that the whole reason why we have a lot of hip-hop music today is because that those artists got access to equipment they wouldn't have gotten access to because of that blackout.
That's wild.
Yeah, it's an interesting theory. There's no way to really test it, but it's interesting to think that one little tiny difference, one guy who got really flustered and hit the wrong button, or hit the wrong button repeatedly, it was the right button if he tapped the control set right, he caused that. So it's one of those things, and, you know, there's another case study of a UI issue on a laser radiation machine that's used for cancer treatments that literally zapped someone, and it shouldn't repeatedly have done what it did. And that was just a keystroke problem on the operator console. So there's a lot of history in human factors engineering of little thing causing huge problem. So I would implore any of our listeners who themselves find themselves thinking, you know, big things must have had big causes, to realize that sometimes big things can have really small causes.
Wow.
And if you're looking for examples of big causes or big things causing little change, just think of all the money that different governments pump into programs that are basically ineffectual, and then you'll see the same thing on the reverse scale. You can also throw a lot of effort into something and have no change because of it.
Yeah, and of course, you know, when we're talking about and it's mostly federal governments in most cases, but you know, they throw a lot of money at very little things. Like, for example, I think the infamous $300 screwdriver and, you know, $50 resistors and things like that. Now, there are some reasons for the $50 resistors, you know, testing tolerances for mil-spec, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, not all of it is bogus. But, you know, it is hard to understand a lot of times. And, you know, having spent a lot of time in government in my life, I know a lot of times when people are trying to express their belief of how government works at the nuts and bolts level, not at the, you know, elected official level, but the day-to-day operational stuff, they have no idea what's going on. You know,
I did tell someone who was positing this very big conspiracy theory to me, remember, the lowest contractor won the bid.
This is often true, you know. I mean, low bid is the enemy of quality. I don't know.
But that was kind of my addition of psychology for our topics today, of just how odd it is that people cling to this belief that big things must have had big causes.
Well, that's, I found it very interesting, John. You know, I have the interest in it, although not the deep background that you do. And I think every now and then you should surface these things. I find them very interesting. I'm sure other people do too.
I try. There's got to be some use for it. I mean, my students don't always listen. So.
I mean, there's some classic stuff we could bring up some days. Like, for example, wasn't there a nuclear facility where this really dangerous thing was on a blue button and, you know, everybody thinks the danger should be red, so they had to, like, paste over some red thing over it so that everybody would understand this is a dangerous thing to push and don't do it?
There's that. There's the number of cases from the 60s where we had near meltdowns or meltdowns of small reactors because of really stupid things.
Yeah.
You know, an 18th of an inch clearance that wasn't maintained or something like that. Yeah, right. It happens.
And even everyday things, like you come to a door and there is no way for you to figure out, am I supposed to push it? Am I supposed to pull it? It's not obvious. I'm looking at the way some mini doors are designed. Anyway, things like that I find fascinating. But in any case, speaking of things I find fascinating, this one not particularly fascinating today, but many years ago, when MS Paint was the only painting tool we had in Windows, it was pretty fascinating. And people did some pretty neat stuff with it. If you want to harken back to the days of MS Paint 1.0, which shipped at all Windows until, I guess it still ships. I guess it's 3D Paint now. Mm-hmm. But there is a web-based thing called JS Paint, jspaint.ml. Free. It's a looks to me like a perfect clone of the old MS Paint, except all you need is a web browser. I have not played with it much, but I did visit it. Hopefully it's not malware. Hopefully that's not what the ML stands for. I don't know what that domain is, to be honest. But I'm a sucker for these things that used to be applications that are now on the web, and it's just amazing. I think when I saw SimCity on the web years ago, don't know what happened to that one, but I thought that was pretty cool. One of my favorite games. I should go look for it again since I keep having to delete the iOS 11 updates from my iPad Pro so I can keep playing Civilization. But I just deleted the update the other day, in fact, to prevent the upgrade to iOS 11.
It's going to get you one day. It really is.
I don't know. We'll see.
Resistance is futile.
Yeah. Anyway, the last topic we have is one I found interesting. You put it down there and said, oh, yeah. I want to hear what John has to say about this.
So I've been thinking a lot about laptops lately because the Apple Cinema display that I used for many years I think may have actually died.
Oh, no.
So at home, all I have is my 13-inch MacBook Pro.
Okay.
And I sent Todd a picture before this of kind of my makeshift solution now. So my iPad Pro through the Duet software that you can download.
Which is amazing.
Is my secondary monitor. So I was using that today for, you know, referencing material on one screen and working on the other screen. And it works fairly well. But it got me thinking about laptops and how long we keep them and how long I was accustomed to keeping them.
Right.
Up until I got my first MacBook in 2009, I basically would upgrade laptops every 2 years, 2.5 years.
Yep.
If I think about, you know, because by then I was running Windows machines, they were getting slower and slower. I'd have to reformat them. And then I got my first MacBook in 2009. And also the hardware would just start failing. and today that MacBook from 2009 is sitting actually in a case over here next to me. I haven't powered it up in a while, but I have no doubt if I were to power it up, it would run just fine.
Yep.
When it got a little slow, I went to a MacBook Air in 2011. And when the battery life on that started going and I thought about what I wanted, I went with the MacBook Pro I have now in 2015. My laptop at work is a work-issued Surface Pro 4. And while I got it a year and a half ago, it's still considered state-of-the-art because there's no Surface Pro 5 yet, if you're a Surface fan.
Well, there's a Surface something.
Yeah, but not what we would consider the next iteration of the tablet Surface Pro.
Okay.
And then today I found this video on YouTube by a YouTuber named Austin Evans where he took a 2009 MacBook, the white MacBook, so not a MacBook Pro, and upgraded it to a terabyte of SSD by by taking out the optical drive so we have more space to put in two 500 gig SSDs, 8 gigs of RAM, and it still is supportive of the latest version of macOS, High Sierra. So it's running High Sierra, and he reports that if you're using it for just basic work and, you know, streaming a few videos and writing emails and all that, it works just fine. So today, how long should a laptop really last? I'm not thinking about replacing my 2015 MacBook Pro, even though it's almost 3 years old. I'm thinking it'll probably last me at least another 2 years. Mm-hmm. The Surface Pro seems to be going strong. It's almost like there's a shift in how I think about laptops, definitely compared to 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, so I would say, and I think I'm probably of a similar mindset to you, but I would say it depends on whether you're primarily a Windows PC user or a Mac OS PC, user. In my experience, and I will admit that it's just me, I don't have any statistics, but I think you may concur, Macs last a long time. I mean, by that I mean they're usable and useful for many, many years.
They do seem to last a lot longer. I have not had a Windows PC go the distance that my Macs have gone.
Yeah.
And when I think about the reasons why I've gone away from Macs that I have, the 2009 MacBook Pro, the whole reason I switched away and bought a MacBook Air was I wanted something smaller.
Right.
At the time, I was traveling a lot. The MacBook Air seemed like a good compromise. I had docking stations everywhere, so the small size didn't bug me too much. Until around 2015, when the battery life on the MacBook Air was starting to really become an issue, and I thought, you know, I really liked the MacBook Pro size, so maybe I should go back to that. And by then, my 2009 MacBook Pro was getting a little slow, and I wanted something better, so I didn't get rid of either of those two laptops. In fact, literally, I haven't. They're both over here. I could power them up right now. I didn't get rid of them because the hardware failed, other than just normal battery cycling issues. Or that the software wasn't supported. It was simply because I wanted something a little bit different, and if I had to, I could still be using that 2009 MacBook Pro today.
Okay, so let me tell you a couple of stories. Speaking of a 2009 MacBook Pro, so I was just using one this morning. Is as our five listeners and John may recall, I have not bought a new Mac for myself since 2010. And that was the second generation MacBook Air, which I call the first good MacBook Air. The original MacBook Air was terrible. So that 2010 MacBook Air today, which is going to be almost, well, it's going to be 8 years old later this year, runs just fine and dandy. It's only got 4 gigs of RAM. It's got 128 gigabytes of SSD, which is a little tiny, but I don't store media on there, so it's not a big deal. Runs fine. Now, I also have a MacBook Pro 2009, which is actually inherited from my daughter. So we got that for her when she started her freshman year of high school, I think. And I had to upgrade that from its, I think it had either 2 or 4 gigs of RAM. I upgraded that to 8 gigs of RAM. No other change. It did have a new hard drive. It did have a hard drive replaced just before the warranty. No, it was actually after the warranty ran out. When my daughter, I think, was like a junior in high school. So it's got a slightly newer hard drive than 2009. But in any case, it runs fine. It was a little sluggish before I upgraded the RAM, but it runs fine. I am currently running, and so in 2009, so we're talking 9 years old, pretty much. And right now I'm using my newest Mac, which is a MacBook Air 2013, which I also inherited from my daughter. So she gets a new Mac every time she graduates from someplace.
it's a good... good kind of system going there for her.
Yeah. So, you know, graduate from 8th grade, get a 2009 MacBook Pro. Graduate from high school, she got a 2013 MacBook Air. Graduate from college, she got a 2017 MacBook Air. So we'll see what happens next time she graduates.
She'll get a bill.
Get a bill. Now I'll get her new Mac. But in any case, so I'm using essentially old Macs, right? I mean, if somebody told you they're using a 2008 PC, you would say, wow, is it still running?
I would say, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, right. Okay, now, turn that around. Just the other day, I was looking at my Dell Inspiron R15 or whatever it is, which is a nice, you know, touchscreen-based 15-inch Dell PC, and thinking, man, this thing is just sluggish, and I, you know, do I need to? And I've done things like I've had to turn off system functions that were useless, like app cache aheads, which, you know, wasn't caching anything properly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, checking on disk I/O and looking for background processes. They were slowing it down and turning them off. And I was just thinking, how old is this thing? You know, without looking it up on the Dell support, you know, support.dell.com or anything. Well, just today I was cleaning up and I was trying to, you know, consolidate boxes and things. And I found a receipt for it. I bought it in 2015. It's not even 3 years old yet. It's like 2.5 years old or something like that. I think I bought it late in the summer of 2015.
And you feel like you've had it forever.
I feel like it's well past its age of retirement. In fact, it's the one of the newest PCs I have.
Yeah, it's newer than the MacBook Pro that I'm using right now on this call.
It's newer than any Mac I have. The 2013 MacBook Pro I'm using now that I inherited from my daughter again this past summer. Thanks. Mm-hmm. it's great. You know, it's fast. It's responsive. Its battery is pretty decent. Can't complain.
Yeah, I hate to say ever that there are rules about platforms, because you'll always find people on both sides that, you know, get very upset about that. Right. My wife has used Windows PCs exclusively her whole life. She's never had a Mac. Somehow hers lasts a crazy long time. I don't know what she's doing on them that I'm not doing, or vice versa, that hers don't seem to become slow, although maybe they become slow and she just doesn't complain too much about them. Okay. I've had to use them, I've found them to be a little slow.
You may be ignoring a conspiracy theory here. She may secretly be a superior system administrator to you, but just doesn't want to make you embarrassed. You haven't thought about that, have you?
That will not embarrass me. I'll just be annoyed that I've had to bumble my way through all the system administration that I have. If she's
already known all this, just didn't want to tell you.
If she is a closet sysadmin, which I never thought could exist,
it could happen.
Maybe that's it. I mean, all of her friends at work do contact her for computer advice.
There you go.
Mostly, I thought because she had lived with me for so long, she picked up a lot of these things. But no, it might be that she's just better at it than I am.
It's like those spy movies, you know, where you're married to a spy and you just never know it.
Yeah, well, I can assure you, Todd, after we get off this call, I'm going to go have a conversation. And I think the conversation is I'm just going to start sprinkling in Unix commands into my language and see if she understands what I'm asking her, you know.
And if she doesn't even flinch, you'll know what's been happening all these years.
Yeah, that's how I'm gonna find her. I'm gonna cat this out real easy. This is all right.
Okay, so
thanks for altering my entire world.
All right. Thought. Conspiracy views at work. But yeah, so my feeling is, you know, and it's not just the sluggishness. I mean, in theory, I suppose I could reformat, rebuild a Dell, except, you know, it's a giant pain because it didn't ship system disks. So I have to trust that the USB thumb drive I built in 2015 actually functions as a bootable device. I guess I should test that.
And then you'll have all of the updates.
Yes. Yes.
From 2015 to now.
Yeah. In fact, wasn't it still Windows 8 back then?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you're in trouble. You just kill it with fire. I mean, it's not gonna be fast for you. I wish I could say that I found good Windows laptops, but there are things I was never able to get working on a Windows laptop. My favorite Windows laptops that I owned, which I still own because I haven't thrown out a laptop ever.
Yeah.
Thankfully, they don't take up a lot of space.
Yeah.
That's why I switched to laptops in 2003, was to not have big, you know, towers sitting around. Yeah. I have never had, for example, a Windows PC reliably go to sleep and wake up.
I hear you.
The Surface Pro is the closest I've come.
And yet it has its problems.
And yet there'll be those days when I plug it in. And I can't plug it straight into its docking station at work. Oh. I have to open it up, let it wake up.
Right.
Let it do
a stretch.
And then plug in the docking station, and then it's fine.
Yeah.
But if you try to do it all at one, sometimes it doesn't know what you want.
Oh, just go ahead.
I've had to, you know, do the hard reboot of it, you know, at least once every 2-3 months since I've had it. So, you know, the power down and power button for 10 seconds.
Right.
Force it to go dead and then restart.
Yeah, just the other day. So what I normally do, at the end of the workday is I sleep the Surface Pro 4 by just unplugging it and, you know, closing the cover, right? Putting it to sleep, putting it in a locked drawer along with a Bluetooth mouse, and then go home. And I come in the next day, and there's a little bit of battery drain, but, you know, nothing significant. And I either plug it in or run to where I'm going to go, and I'm good. And, you know, I have a spare charger with me when I'm running around. Well, one morning the other day, I come in, I rush to a meeting. I've got 0% battery.
It never went to sleep.
It never went to sleep, even though I do the exact same thing every day.
Yep.
Thank
I you don't. I've never got that, but yet I have a friend who maybe is again an ultimate system admin, better than you and I, who has had, he claims, Windows Sleep and Hibernation working just fine on every laptop he's ever had.
Well, I would say they work mostly fine, but not 100% of the time.
See, for me, the day that I opened up my MacBook Pro for the first time and then closed it and then opened it a few hours later and it came back to life within 2 seconds.
Yeah.
That was the day I went, what have I been doing my whole life? You know, that was the moment where I saw what Microsoft had promised me my Windows PCs were supposed to do that I'd never seen them do.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm happy that I'm on both Windows and Mac these days. I've talked about it on here before that I'm happy I have a Windows PC and that I have my MacBook and I have my iPad and my iPhone. But I just don't understand how these seemingly simple things that Apple can do, Microsoft can't do.
Yeah, and I should also note I have a I bought it in January 2008, but it's a late model 2007 iMac, and it's still running. I did upgrade it from 2 to 4 gigabytes of RAM a couple years ago, based on being inspired by you, John. Because prior to that, I was not brave enough to do it, but you gave me the courage to do so, and it's running fine. It's pretty. It's over 10 years old now.
I will mention one of the reasons I'm probably also not in a big hurry to upgrade this MacBook Pro from 2015 is that it does have 16 gigs of RAM.
Oh.
And so I've never had a real sluggish issue with this PC, which is kind of strange when you think about how RAM used to need to be upgrading every few years your RAM, and now for about the last 6 or 7 years, 8 to 16 will get you what you need.
Unless you're doing something really, maybe not unusual, but something like lots of video rendering, if you're trying to make the next great American movie, or if you're doing something of that sort, simulating, you know, the worldwide atmospheric movement. you know, most things these days run fine, 8 gigs of RAM.
Yeah.
Map unless rendering could use a little bit more, but in my experience.
Unless you're trying to create the next virtual currency.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, yeah, if you're doing bit mining, I suppose, or Bitcoin mining, or whatever it's called. We should get a cryptocurrency expert friend on here one of these days, because it's apparently been a lot more volatile than expected recently, and I don't understand why.
I kind of think I understand why here and there, but I will at least, I can end the podcast on a happy story.
Okay.
A few weeks ago now, the end of December, mid-December, when Bitcoin went up to around 17,000.
Yeah.
A friend of mine and I were talking with a third friend.
Okay.
And third friend owns, at that time, one Bitcoin. He had it forever and ever. And he was talking about how it was so, he was happy that it was at 17,000. We said, you know, we both think this might be a little inflated. We think we would advise you, we're not financial advisors, but as your friend, to maybe sell off enough of your Bitcoin so that you get back whatever you initially invested into it, which was like $200 or $400 whenever you bought in.
Right.
And then take a little profit off of the top, and then you still have, you know, a half a Bitcoin or whatever you're going to save that you can ride out the storm with and see what happens.
Yeah.
And our friend was very insistent, no, I'm going to keep it in there because to cash it out now would be stupid.
Okay.
Said, okay, think about it. A couple days later, he let us both know, you know, I thought about what you said, I cashed out some of it, and so now it's all whatever's in there. It could all go away, and I still came out ahead. And he posted that, I think, 2 or 3 days before it dropped again.
Wow.
So when it dropped, we both, that was one of the few times in my life I haven't been able to contain myself. I did do a little bit of I told you so. But that's just kind of the craziness of it. If you can make money off of it intelligently, it's a great time to do it. But I don't think there's enough that we know about it to have for sure winning strategies.
Right, right.
We've covered a lot of ground in this podcast.
We have, yeah. Considering we really didn't know what we were going to talk about, that was pretty amazing.
How is 238 different from any of the 237 previous? You know?
Right, right. There you go. There you go. And that's about it. There really wasn't that much going on, you know. And after all, the whole missile thing, everything else was kind of minor in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. Every day that you wake up and you're still there, you're happy. I think that's how we all should live everywhere.
Yeah. Okay, so that's episode 238. 230. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to live long enough for episode 2000, but we had fun. We're going to have fun trying to hit maybe 500, maybe 1000. We'll see. I think 500 is doable. I have to figure out a way to will you this podcast so you can take it to at least 1000.
Yeah. But and then anyway, I'll sucker someone into it. It'll just keep going.
So, in any case, again, my new tagline is, you know, hope you're having a wonderful missile-free weekend. And we will talk to you next time.